Hi everyone. I'm Anna Olds. I am an I6 resident at the University of California, Southern California. I'm also the current vice president of TSRA. We're really excited to be doing this series. We're covering a lot of different topics on personal wellness, including we did a previous webinar on personal finance, and one just wasn't enough. So we'll be covering some different topics today. I'll let Dr. Erkman introduce herself from the TSDA standpoint.
Hello, my name is Sherry Erkman. I'm a program director at Temple, and I'm representing the TSDA part of this collaboration. And Dr. Olds and I have thought about well-being and trying to apply it to what we as cardiothoracic surgeons define as well-being. So it's not just time away from work or time that you spend with your family. It also encompasses parts of the job of well-being, including financial well-being, including the relevance of the work and the value that we place on our work, that the work is commensurate with our training, our interest, our mission, that we're always working towards a goal, and that we have interconnectivity. So this webinar series is trying to connect all of us and touch on all of these components of well-being. So one of our goals is financial well-being, and so I'll let Dr. Olds introduce our panel. Oh, Dr. Olds, you're on mute.
Thank you. We have lots of great speakers on our panel tonight. So I want to thank all of you for joining and giving some good information to all of our attendees. So first, I'll introduce Dr. Melanie Edwards, who is a thoracic surgeon at Trinity Health in Michigan. She's also the first vice president in the Southern Thoracic Surgical Association. We also have Dr. Dan Logsdon, who is a cardiac surgeon in private practice at Eisenhower Health in California. And Dr. Deesha Spath is an internal medicine physician in New York. She developed her business called The Frugal Physician to help physicians navigate finances and debt. She was also an ambassador and a columnist for The White Coat Investor and now hosts her own podcast called Finding Financial Freedom as part of her company. And Tyler Rivetti is a financial advisor in California, where he owns and operates a financial advisory firm specifically dedicated to physicians, including residents. And he specializes in disability insurance, investments, and general financial planning. I also want to let everyone who's attending know that we have a Q&A. So please feel free to use the Q&A. We'll be monitoring that throughout the webinar. I guess we'll go ahead and start with some questions. So, Dr. Edwards, I was hoping that you could tell us kind of what are the components of your income as an attending cardiothoracic surgeon in academics. What are the things, the elements that go into your salary, and where are the negotiable aspects in terms of bonuses, RVUs, et cetera?
For full disclosure, I'm actually in a hospital group employed setting, but I've worked in two academic practices before. And what I will say is that the components are different, and it really is institutions specific. A lot of it depends on who actually hires you and how what the relationship is between your medical school and the hospital. For example, most of you who are or if you're employed in an academic position as an assistant professor, et cetera, you will be employed by the medical school of medicine. But most of your revenue or most of your income is going to come from your clinical work. And that's going to have to be generated or negotiated through either a hospital that is either a separate entity that is affiliated with the medical school. Some medical schools own their own hospital. And so there are some nuances there. And so you'll see on an academic side your compensation broken down into a few components. But first is you'll have a clinical pay, and that'll depend on what's called your percent effort. So it'll either be 50, 60, 70, 80% of however much of your income that is dedicated to clinical work. You will also get usually a pretty fixed stipend or amount of your compensation for teaching. than for whatever research. And so, you know, there are several points of negotiation. Some are more negotiable than others. Universities, though, there, I think the distinction is blurring, as a lot of universities go towards RVU-based models for physician compensation, because the realities of healthcare are, as I said, the clinical enterprise is what really pays for a lot in the medical school, frankly. So, your elements there will depend on whether you're productivity based, if you have a base plus a productivity bonus, or if you're entirely productivity based, which is unusual, but there are some places that do that, or if you have a base salary and then maybe a incentive or bonus based on, say, quality metrics, or you know, however that is phrased. And so that's going to vary from institution to institution. But it's important to know specifically where you work or where you're looking to work, what are the components, and then look for those negotiable factors, such as your base RVU, I mean, your base salary starting out. They may say, oh, well, unless. I mean, I think there are very few institutions that pay everybody a fixed rate. There are some, but not that many. So I think there are several points that you can look at negotiating and make sure you have accurate benchmark data for both your region and the type of institution.
Thank you. Dr. Logsdon, looking back, what do you wish you knew about negotiating your first job and understanding from where the money comes? What advice do you have for us?
Yeah, so that's a good question. I think this is something that, you know, in training, you don't really talk about it much. You know, you're mostly concerned about patient care. Sometimes you get the comment about, hey, we need to document this better because it changes our billing profile. So you hear some comments, but you don't really get into that until you kind of get your first job. And it's like everything else. We're our own business, whether you're in private practice, you're an academic physician, you're employed. Doesn't matter, right? You are your own business. So you generate your own revenue based on the work that you do. And so I think that's one of the first thing there is you generate that. The second thing that, you know, I didn't fully understand was what is a work RVU? How are they negotiated? How do you get paid based on that? And, you know, RVUs are relative value units. So all across medicine, they attempt to equalize work, you know, relative value units across all specialties. And so depending on what you might be doing, if it's a bypass surgery with three grafts, probably going to be like 45 work RVUs. They produce a book every year. Medicare produces a book, and that's kind of where that information comes from. And that's pretty much a fixed rate that gets paid. And it's all, everything's kind of based off what Medicare said. So I didn't know that, number one. So you come out and you have to decide on how many RVUs you're gonna make, right? And so typically your first contract's gonna be an employed salary contract, which is fine, you know, because you're gonna come out and you're not gonna produce much revenue. And it's a nice thing that the hospital hire you and put you on a salary typically. But when you go to negotiate that first contract, you really need to think about what the future of your career there looks like. Meaning, you know, you need to think about what it's gonna look like in 2 or 3 years when you have a practice built up. And so what I would encourage you to do, and what the advice I wish I had, because I'm in contract negotiations now that just wrapped up, is really looking at what, you know, the first 2 years are probably going to be pretty fixed salaries. You might get a slight increase that you can negotiate from year one to year two, but really you need to think about what years three, four, five look like for you. And I would say probably 80% of the groups that I've looked at go off of a work RVU basis. So you produce a certain amount of RVUs, and then they compensate you based on the RVUs. And that's a very wide range that they pay per RVU, and it's very much specialty specific. So if you are internal medicine, right, you're going to get $1 per RVU rate. If you're CT surgery or your neurosurgery or orthopedics or cardiology or endocrine or oncology, they all have different negotiated dollars per RVU. But at that point there, they're on a scale. They're on a range. I know this is kind of getting in the weeds, but it can range anywhere from, you know, $40 an RVU upwards to $110 an RVU, right? And so the hospitals have some mandates to kind of fix you somewhere between the 60th and 75th percentile. And that's to mean that, you know, you can't go out and pay your physicians more money per RVU to try to attract them. That's part of the stark laws that are out there, and that's that will get them audited, that'll get them fined. And so there are rules around how much per RVU they can pay you. And so what I would say, when you come into your second term, you have to realize what those limitations are. And there's probably three or four different groups out there that compile that data from different hospitals to tell you what that value is, so you have an idea of what you can ask for. And then the second thing that they do at a lot of academic centers is they're going to give directorships, right? They're going to say you're the director of X, the director of Y, because that's outside of what Medicare says they can pay you for, right? It's outside of your work RVUs. And so that's things that they can tack on to your salary down the road to kind of get you up to a point where you think it's negotiable. So I know that's a lot to talk about, but what I wish I had known, if I boiled it down to three things: one, your first 2 years are probably going to be salary. Two, you need to negotiate in your first contract the timing of your second contract, when that will be negotiated, and where you'll be heading. Will you be heading to production, or are you going to go to a base salary with some bonus on top of that? And so you need to really get that spelled out early on and get it in writing, because that's going to help you determine what you're going to do by year three.
That was very helpful. Thank you. There are a lot of elements that go into a contract, it seems like. I wondered, Dr. Spath, how do you deal with contract negotiation and giving advice to physicians when they're looking at this? Do you have specific advice, or if anybody else wants to jump in about the elements of a contract, where you can actually make differences and where you can't?
Contracts are, most hospitals will tell you that they're not negotiable, but there's a lot there that can be negotiated. Most contracts will, specify a salary, and they might say, this is what we pay everyone. But then there's time off. There is CME money. There is things that Dr. Longston mentioned. So RVU compensation, how much compensation are you getting? What's the threshold at which you start getting that RVU compensation if you have a fixed salary? So a lot of that is negotiable. So where do you get the data? Certainly, you can go to your professional societies. There's MGMA data. Or you could go to recruiters. Actually, recruiters, if you can build a good relationship with the recruiters around, they can kind of give you a general idea. Or general, if you can get emails from recruiters, and you'll see the different salaries being offered for your specialty. And that's kind of a good way to get a gist of what people are making in your area. And then going from there, you really sit down with yourself and ask yourself, what is important to you? Is it time off? Is it how much money can I make? Is it quality of life? Am I looking at directorships? Am I looking for growth opportunities? These are the things that you want to go into the negotiation being very clear about. I know it's tough when you're young and you don't know exactly what you want, but if you are clear on that and you can lay out exactly what you need, people will work hard to make you happy and to recruit you. Dr. Longston, did you have any thoughts on that?
No, I think being very specific about what you want. So when I moved out, they're going to give you some signing bonus typically. That's not a great negotiating point. But what I negotiated, and I know a lot of academic places do this, but not a lot of private places do it. I want to buy a house. I have family, and so I said, hey, look, I want a loan, 200 grand loan. So that's what I need to buy a house. I'll pay it back over 7 years, 0% interest. So I floated them by that information, and they said, yeah, we'll do it. I said, that's what I need to come out here, because you are a valued entity, right? There are very few cardiac surgeons and thoracic surgeons being produced every year. And as we know, if you look at the STS data, like the age range of people, they said 55 to 65, that's like 33% of the workforce right now in cardiac surgery and thoracic surgery. And so they're going to be retiring, and there's a huge need coming out there. So you have to realize that, but you don't want to come out being cocky, but you want to come out very specific and have very specific asks. They're going to meet those needs. So I'm currently paying back an interest-free $200,000 loan, which bought me a house. And I live in Southern California, so that made a huge difference for me, being able to stabilize that, because that was something that I didn't want to have to save up for to get a down payment. I wanted to just do that. And one of the things they liked about it was it showed that I was committed to them for 7 years. I said, hey, look, this is a great thing for you, because if I don't if I move on, I got to pay this back to you. So you've got me for, 7 years. And so that was part of my negotiating point. And I think that went over very well. So I think all the other points you made are great. I think you're going to need advice coming out of training to do that. You're going to need access to some of the data. And a lot of us have that data that are happy to share it. It's not always all publicly available easily, but it's all available to get that.
Yeah, I would actually add what I forgot to mention is there are professionals out there. There are companies that will help you negotiate. There are physician-specific companies out there that have lawyers that will review your contract. And I do highly recommend that most physicians get their contracts reviewed by a lawyer because there's a lot of language in there. Some of it can be confusing, but not really. Most physicians can understand what's in there, but the important thing to know is what's not in there. The points of clarification that you want in there. What's the call schedule? What exact locations will I be practicing at? A lot of people get surprised at the location that they end up in. Sometimes it might be several different points in that company. So it's very important that your contract states what you think it states, and have a professional review that and make sure it's in writing.
Yeah, I agree. I think having, I had an attorney look over mine briefly. There's going to be compete, non-compete clause in there probably, which whether they're enforceable or not, I think it depends on the state you live in. Those are things to look at. There's also going to be a section in your contract. And again, feel free to reach out because this is going to be very specific to where you're signing on to what, you're working academics, private, but there's going to be a section there where you can kind of lay out your asks, meaning not just financial ask, but like, hey, I want to be able to practice, I want to be able to be on staff at the hospital down the street. Now's the time to get it all put out there, right? And so I put in there that I wanted to be have the option to be on staff at another hospital. I wanted to put the option that I have, the ability to do some consultant work. I have a separate like little men's health practice that I ran while I was in residency as well, taking care of some athletes. And I put that in my contract that that needed to be in there, that I need to be able to keep doing that. And so I think the first contract is really a good time to put it all out because that's kind of the initial marriage contract, right? Like they want you, they're pursuing you. Now's your time to put those in there in writing. And most of the time, all of that's going to be fine. But I think having an attorney review that is going to be very important just to make sure you understand what's in there. Now, whether you're going to be able to redline that and make changes, probably not. But there's something called a side letter that you can ask for. And so a lot of contracts that I do have side letters on them. So here's the boilerplate that everybody gets. But I can tell you that a lot of contracts allow you to attach a side letter to it, which spell out specific things that are just unique for you. And so it's okay to do those things.
Dr. Spath, you mentioned reaching out to a recruiter and asking, for help and getting all of that information from the recruiters. When would you advise people in training to do that? When would you advise that we go out and make a relationship with a recruiter?
I think you'll start getting calls probably your last year. I am internal medicine, so I'm not as familiar with cardiothoracic recruitment cycles, but generally for internal medicine, our third year, end of second year even, I guess a year out or a little bit more than a year out from finishing training is when we start getting the recruitment calls. And not all recruiters are going to be helpful. I'm more talking about hospital-specific recruiters, some of the more private companies, the private companies that are just looking to hire a doctor, kind of anywhere can be a little bit less helpful. But if you're talking to the hospitals in the area that you want to go to, you can directly reach out to those recruiters at the hospital and start talking to them and get some, maybe not salary data, that would be super helpful, but you can start to compare and contrast what each institution offers and get a better idea of exactly what you're dealing with going into attendinghood.
So this year we had our first ever compensation survey. It was run by the STS, and it has a robust database. It is about 20 to 30% of the whole thoracic surgery population, but it does reflect that it is available to STS members. And it's also a play here for all of us to complete that member survey because it gives us exactly what you want, the specialty specific data based on subspecialties. It's a very big difference between cardiac and thoracic, very big difference in terms of the regions where you practice and the type of practice that you have. So I do encourage people to look at the compensation survey and on the STS website. But I wanted to bring Tyler into the story here. So we're building a contract, we're building a life. And what type of things do we think about? I think Dr. Logsdon had the foresight to say, okay, I need to buy a house. What other things should we be planning for upon graduation and our financial profile?
Yeah, there's really a lot of things that residents need to consider, and that list is going to grow as you grow, and not just your career, but your life in general. So you got to get, your contract squared away, get, your home squared away, figure out where you're going to live. Got to get all these different things squared away. As you continue to grow, I know kind of estate planning was going to come up as a topic. And that can mean so many different things to so many different people, depending on where you're at in your life. At the very basic for a resident, it's going to be things like making sure your accounts are titled correctly. If you have an individual account, a joint account, if you are in a community property state, for example, California, you want to have your accounts titled as joint community property. Reason being is you get certain tax benefits for community property versus just general joint held accounts. So there's a lot of different things that come up when the topic of estate planning happens. And not to make it into a morbid conversation, but when you hear estate planning, it's always, okay, what's going to happen to my assets after I pass away? And that's hard for a young doctor to think about. So you really just kind of start with the basics, and as you grow in your career, grow in your life, things are going to change. You get married, you have a family. It's going to change from making sure your accounts are titled correctly to setting up a trust. And the reason why you would set up a trust is when we pass away, all of your assets are going to be allocated to, if you have a will, according to your will, that's where the assets are going to be allocated to, but it's going to go through a process called probate. You may have never heard of probate before, but it is a very long process and it can sometimes cost a lot of money if you have a large estate.
To
So
avoid it.
what's that, Dan?
I said just avoid it.
Yeah, there are ways to avoid probate. Very basic is to name beneficiaries on your account. If you have a retirement account, and it's not just retirement accounts, you can do it for a savings account, a checking account. You would ask for something that's called a transfer on death. And on a transfer on death form, you can name a beneficiary. The TOD accounts are going to be able to skip probate. So your other assets are all going to go through probate where the court's going to say, okay, your assets are going to go to this person, that person. If you name beneficiaries on your account, you know specifically while you are alive who your account is going to go to. The other reason why you want to avoid probate is it's public record. So if your assets are all allocated through probate, somebody could go down to the local clerk's office, pull the records, and see a list of all of your assets. Certain things might be redacted in there, like social security numbers, dates of birth, that kind of stuff, but it is public record through probate. So there are ways, as Dan, Dr. Logsdon mentioned, to avoid probate. You can set up a living trust, sometimes referred to as a revocable trust. And with that, you would essentially move all of your assets into the trust. You would move your home into the trust, your bank accounts into the trust. So when you have a checking account, it's not in your name anymore, it's in the name of the trust. The trust owns your house. And a lot of people feel like when this topic comes up, okay, I'm giving away control over all of my assets. That's not the case. It's your trust. You are the owner of the trust, you're the trustee, you are the beneficiary of that trust while you are alive. It's the same thing as if you have your own practice. You set up your own corporation. You own the corporation. The corporation has the bank accounts. You control the bank accounts. Same thing with your personal finances. You set it all up in a trust. You transfer your assets into the trust. You have full control. You are the trustee and the beneficiary of that trust while you are alive. And along with that, if you have kids, you would name guardians to take care of your kid. There's a lot of things that go into it. It's really just the process of planning and making sure all of your assets are distributed and going and doing exactly what you want them to do. But it's a process that has to be done earlier, sooner rather than later, while we are alive. Otherwise, everything's going to go through probate if you do not plan. And it's really a process for your family. Nothing's going to cause a feud, more so with your family than throwing a house and letting your siblings or your kids go fight over, who gets the house, or trying to split a house down the middle. It just doesn't work. So there are ways to kind of address all of this through proper estate planning, through like wills, trust, power of attorneys. Want to make sure you have an advanced healthcare directive thrown in there. Usually you would take care of all of this in one shot. And as your family grows, you grow in your finances, your career, all of these things can be amended just to change with your circumstances.
Sounds like a lot of people will need your help.
Yeah, I think Tyler's right too. Just real quick on a trust, as a physician, I think you got to remember a trust is like a separate living body. It's separate than you. It's another person, right? That's what you have to think about it. And so it can own things, right? Now you can control it, and that's all that matters. But Tyler's right. I think, for physicians looking at setting up a trust for your home, I put mine in a trust. It's good asset protection, which, you just have to think about that in our profession. So yeah, attorneys can help you set that up pretty easily. It's very state specific though.
There's one question in the chat that I'm gonna bring up. The question is, I'm a salaried general thoracic attending at an academic center, but haven't had a raise in 5 years. Besides RVU, what data do I need to negotiate my second contract? I wondered if one of you wanted to answer that.
Yeah, I mean, I can at least think about some elements. So, in an academic center, there's likely a lot of work that you do that is probably non-specifically revenue generating, that takes time and effort, that provides value in some form for the hospital. So, besides, being having a record of, your RVUs and where you are relative to the institutional expectations, you really want to have a very good record of that. All the committees, any directorships, as was mentioned before, all of that counts. So anything that you take your time to do, you should get compensated for in some form, either by getting academic credit for it or by some sort of financial incentive. So, you don't. Some of it is institutional service, but that should be accounted for in your contract. Plus, think about your future career goals too. And, now's the opportunity to think about where you want to go in the next 5 years and how the institution can help you get there. Are there certain, do you want to go down to 0.8 FTEs and maybe use more of your time for research or, reallocate your time? So there's a lot that you can do at this opportunity. And just remember that even if you think it's always easier to keep you and renegotiate and keep you happy, and it's a lot more expensive to replace you.
Yeah,
Correct.
that's a big negotiating point.
That's well said, Melanie. I think the other point there is I would just challenge you is like, do you know the data? Like, do you know the information you're going in, right? When you go into surgery, you know the shit forward and backwards. But do you know your compensation data forward and backward? Do you know all the people that are producing the data? Do you know Sullivan Cotter? Do you know MD Ranger? Do you know MD GMA? Do you know what the STS survey says? Like, I hate to say this, but I can just tell you, administration, they're going to leave you. If you're happy, they're going to let you stay at status quo, right? You're going to have to come with the information. and present it to them, you know, and you're going to have to put together a case to why you have an increase in your ROI. Why am I a better employee and why should I be paid more? You're going to have to show them that. And if it's not RVU data driven, and maybe it is, maybe your RVUs are fine, but they're paying you at the 45th percentile for your work RVUs. Well, do you know what you should be getting paid at? Well, you should be getting paid the 60 to 75th percentile. Can you quote those numbers? No, but you can quote cancer statistics. So learn a little bit about what's going on. And I think that'll make a huge difference. And again, it's not cockiness. It's just being on a level playing field and understanding the confines that the administration has to work in. That's what I had to learn this year. There are confines that they have to work in. They want to make you happy, like Melanie said. They don't want to lose you, but you got to play the game that they need you to play, right? Directorships work dollar per RVU under a certain amount. They can make that happen. They can look at your call pay adjustments. They can look at time off adjustments. I mean, there's a whole lot of things that they can work into that. You just have to know the information, and it's all very available.
Yeah, and you know, and if you're uncomfortable negotiating for yourself, there are again services out there that will do it for you. You can hire physician contract review companies to renegotiate your contract, and they will have this data for you. And they will also go and search in the nearby facilities. I mean, depending on what your non-compete is, but they can look at what other doctors are getting paid in the area, and they can say, okay, well, this doctor can earn this here. If you want to keep them, this you might want to increase your pay to be competitive to this other pay that's being offered for the same position. There are other people you can hire to do that for you if you want.
And if you're a fellow of the American College of Surgeons, their website has some resources with, I think there's a 10% discount for one of the companies there that will review contracts in their specific you know tiers that you can go for. And also don't be afraid to look for another job. You know, just go out there and interview and figure out what else is out there. At 5 years out, you know, this may be, I mean, I hate to say this, but this you know that can also be a negotiating tool. You don't want to pull that card too frequently because it's like the boy that cried wolf. But on the other hand, if you know really you know want to know what my true value is in the marketplace, then maybe go into the marketplace.
Absolutely. And that's where you can get some of that good information from the recruiters.
And in an academic institution, you also have to think about what is your contribution to teaching. So a lot of times that's not reimbursed, but if you spend a significant amount of time teaching, you can negotiate for some of your RVU expectation to be lowered because of your teaching commitment. And you can also look to the medical school for increased teaching jobs so that you take on new responsibilities. But Dr. Edwards is right. You have to figure out what it is you like to do and then start negotiating for RVUs and a reduction of that to pay for, you know, the direction, whether it be research or teaching or directorships. So, but I wanted to switch tack a little bit. We talked about houses and how to finance them, how they fit into your future. All of us are, you know, looking at the house as an asset, but it's also where we live. You know, what kind of advice do you have as we move to a new job, a new location? Anyone, personal experience or general experience, how do you manage a house, a loan, and interest rates and such?
I'll go first. I think the first, if you don't know whether you like the job or not, if you don't know the area, this would be a good time to rent. The first job that you get and move to, and you most of the time, a lot of the times, we're moving to a new part of the country. Make sure you like the area first before you buy a house, because buying a house can be a money losing proposition in the first 2 to 5 years, especially in this interest rate environment. So there are a lot of costs that go into buying and selling a house, all the commissions you have to pay, all the cleanup, and all of that that you have to do to get rid of the house. What if you want to move within the next 2 to 5 years? So make sure you like the area first, and it is okay to rent for the first year or two. You don't have to commit. If you want to be like Dr. Longson and use it as a negotiating tool, that's awesome. But you don't have to do that. It's generally advised that you rent just to get to know the area if you're new to the area.
Correct.
And then if you want to buy, there are several options out there for physicians. Physicians do have access to physician loans, which are better at financing almost 100% of the cost of the house. So some lenders will give you no money down loans. Some will make you pay maybe 5% down, but there are generally better terms. But you have to realize that when you're putting less money down, you have less equity in the house. So if you ever go turn around and go sell the house, or God forbid, housing values fall in your area. We haven't seen that happen recently, but a lot of us have lived through the 2008 real estate crash, and it has happened in the past. Just keep in mind that if you don't put anything down, then you are taking on more risk. You're taking on leverage risk. But for physicians, the physician mortgage can be a good way to buy the first house because you don't have to put it as much down, and you don't have to pay private mortgage insurance, which is simply money that you pay the bank to give you that loan with no money down. It has no value to you, and you don't want to pay it. So that PMI not being there is humongous. And they generally also don't count your student loans. Sometimes they're more generous with this debt-to-income ratio requirements for physicians, knowing that you're going to be working more. You're going to be making a lot of money, and generally physicians pay back their loans. They're not people that walk away from debt, so they give you better terms because of that, and they don't count your student loans into your debt to income ratio in certain situations. And then also they are more generous with the lending requirements for physicians. So knowing that that's out there, it is still, if you can put down 20%, that is the best way to buy a house for the safety risk of not being upside down on the house. So if you can put that something down, that although I will say I've bought my first two houses with nothing down. And that worked out okay, but that you just have to realize that you're taking extra risk when you do that.
Yeah, and I'd be interested in others' thoughts. I bought my place here on a physician loan, but I did a 15-year fixed. And so, that was kind of my way to quickly build equity in the property. And that was another, just another thing to consider. You don't always have to do a 30-year traditional mortgage. The payments are higher, but you just have to balance out how much house you really need versus how long you want to carry that debt.
Yeah,
That's pretty
absolutely.
good.
I
Go ahead,
don't.
Tyler.
Oh, you want to go down?
It
Go
doesn't
for
matter.
it.
All right. I'll start with this. Your house is not an asset, it's a liability. You need a place to live, right? So you have to have some place to live, right? And there's no tax, there's really not a lot of tax benefits for owning a house. I saw it as a negotiating point for me to get into something without any money down, but still have equity in it. That's why I did it that way. I never would have put cash into a house right now. I think the interest rates you have to look at. You have to also remember, and again, I mean, we can go down rabbit holes here, but investment properties are very depreciable. And what you're going to quickly find out is what it's like to pay taxes. And you're going to quickly realize like everything else you don't like in life is not as bad as paying taxes. So, there's very good ways around appropriately getting depreciable assets that you can then use to offset your W-2 income if set up appropriately. And so I would just encourage you, I think Dish is right. I think renting first is good, right? Because you can walk away. You got no strings attached. And most of you have a lot of financial liability already. You already got a lot of debt. You need to get your financial house in order, right? And that's why I tell you, your house is a liability. It is not an asset. You owe on that. Renting, you can walk away from at any point. It's fine. You can go get a smaller house. You can go to a smaller, place to rent. You get a bigger place to rent. And until you get your house in order, people are gonna tell you like, oh my God, you're throwing away money. Well, not if you're being smart with what you're doing with your other money that you're making, right? And what you don't realize and what most people don't talk about is risk. Risk is a very real thing. And as surgeons, we know about risk, right? We take it every day. we assume risk to do surgeries, but there's a lot of financial risks with what you do. Owning a house, there's a lot of financial risk. You are signing a guarantee that you will pay this back, right? Same thing when you signed up at the age of 23 or 22 to take on $300,000 in medical school debt. You have no idea that you are liable for that. That is a huge risk that you signed up for. And so I think you have to mitigate some of those risks before you really go down the path of like finding that dream home. And again, that's just my opinion, but I look at it from that lens.
Yeah, I agree with what everyone just said. It's, every year I have residents coming to me or recently graduated residents saying, everyone's telling me to buy a house. It's good for taxes. It's good for investments. It's best to rent until you are absolutely set and stable. You know where you're going to be. You know where you're going to be working. You might have a job opportunity come up that you weren't expecting. Now you got to move. It's best to wait until you are more certain about things. I have very mixed feelings about these physician mortgages just because a lot of residents and young doctors will look at it as a way to buy a bigger house. And that's not the case. It can be good as really just a tool to help you build wealth. Not as a tool to stretch your budget. If you're looking at a house and you can have 20% saved up, but if you can still do better with your money somewhere else, then sure, put less down, put a little bit extra into your practice, grow your practice if you're going to see a better return by investing more into your practice and more into yourself. But if you're putting nothing down as a way to afford a house, it usually is not a good idea. If something happens, you need to sell the house. Housing markets go up, they go down. It's a very easy way to find yourself underwater and owing more on the house than what you're actually going to get for it if you sell it. So it just, as everyone had already said, it's a very risky strategy. Make sure you know where you're going to be working, that you're comfortable in that area. Just get yourself settled, have enough saved, use it as a tool to build more wealth, not as a tool to stretch your budget and buy a bigger house.
Well, I think,
Oh,
go ahead.
sorry.
Sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say, having downsized, I downsized after buying and attending house. And then 2 years later, realizing that I made the wrong move. And I downsized back to like a residency sized house, just to about 2,000 square feet. And that is painful. You can always level up, right? You can always, don't feel like you have to buy your dream home at your first job. It is very important that you, if you can, just buy as much house as is absolutely necessary to keep you happy. Whatever square footage that is, however many rooms that is, but if you buy just enough of what you need and to keep you happy, then you can always upgrade later. There's plenty of time for that, but it's very painful going from a large house then back down to a smaller house. And having done that, it was 100% worth it. But if you can continue to live like a resident for a little bit longer and maybe not super, super upgrade your lifestyle right after your fellowship, your residency, then you can make huge financial headway and really set yourself for success, set yourself up for success in the future if you can just get that financial headway going.
So, what about we talk about housing debt? We have lots of other types of debt. It could be car loans, school loans. Anybody have advice on how to manage it and prioritize it?
Yeah, I fortunately I'm at the point where I just have a mortgage, but I came out with all the debt. And it was painful, but for me it was a personally important and I thought financially important to get rid of the debt, even though from an interest rate standpoint, probably, you can look at it two ways. There's the how you want to look at your debt and what role debt plays in your life versus playing around with, oh, my debt is at a 2% interest rate and I can make 10% in the market. Yeah, that I think is more of a iffy way to look at it. And so usually I think just first your high interest credit card debt, that should be paid off as soon as possible. And as a CT surgery attending, you should never have to carry that, frankly, in my opinion. And then next year, student loans and housing and car debt. Same with car debt. You know, I don't think, I think most of us should be able to drive a car without much debt to that. It's similar high interest. And then you're just looking at your student loans, which fortunately there are places where you can refinance, consolidate your loans, and then you know, sit down and have a really thought out, well-written strategy for, okay, I want to pay my student loans off by X, set a date, a target date, and then revolve everything else around that. So then you're not being pulled in multiple different directions from a financial standpoint. So that's just my advice, and I'm very glad I did it finally. Took too long, but better late than never.
I totally agree with Dr. Edwards. I've at the risk of monopolizing this conversation, this is something I've talked and thought about. I've thought about this quite a lot. You know, Dave Ramsey has his baby steps for the general population, but unfortunately, I didn't feel like it fit physicians very well because we are so late in the investing game already because we have such a long training pathway, and most of our college friends have been investing for 10 years by the time we start investing. And that investment compounding is so important in building wealth. So I kind of modified it. So here's what my baby steps. My first one is, first of all, to get the adequate insurance. We haven't talked about insurance yet, but that's incredibly important. Then to get a starter emergency fund. But for physicians, instead of $1,000, like Dave Ramsey recommends, we could do $10,000 because we do have a lot more liability, especially with our high deductible healthcare plans that most of us get from our employer. So at least the largest amount of your deductible is you want to have as a starter emergency fund. And then you really want to start investing in those retirement accounts. You know, you don't want to put that off for much longer. So start investing and start game planning what you're going to be doing. Game planning student loans. I paid all of mine off, but honestly, you don't have to anymore. And if there are ways that you can get forgiveness, then look at that. Yeah, game plan if you do, qualify for public service loan forgiveness, if that's something you want to do. If you want to do IDR forgiveness or the long-term forgiveness, the SAVE plan is pretty favorable these days. You're not accumulating any interest on month as you go forward with those student debts. So game plan the student loans. See if you want to pay them off or not. And then knock out that high interest debt. Dr. Edwards was totally right. There's no reason physicians should carry credit card debt. We make way too much money for that. And that's like 18, 20% we're talking about that you're paying to the credit card companies. So get rid of that. And then max out that retirement space. There's a lot of retirement account space that physicians have available to them, especially if you're working in an academic setting. You have those 401, the 403Bs or 401Ks. If you're in a private setting, you have 457s where you could be putting money. You have access to mega backdoor Roth sometimes in academic settings, but you also, everyone has access to the backdoor Roth IRA that they can be investing in as well. There are solo 401Ks, FSAs, HSAs, there's so many accounts that you could be putting money at where you don't pay taxes on the growth of that money. And then sometimes you don't even pay taxes when you withdraw that money in Roth accounts. And sometimes you don't pay taxes when you put it in, when it grows, or when you take it out. And that's an HSA. So those accounts are incredibly wealth building, incredibly powerful wealth building tools. So if you can start maxing those out early in your career, you're going to be great. And after that, pay off all the rest of the debt. Pay off the car. No reason for you to carry a car loan. And then save up that 3 to 6 month emergency fund. So we're talking about essential expenses, things that you have to pay. You know, your mortgage, whatever other debt you're carrying, and your food, your transportation expenses, the work expenses. So just the basics that you need to keep your family going. Make sure you have 3 to 6 times that. So monthly expense times 3 to 6. And that's your emergency fund. So that's the fund that will be there for you should life happen, should the heater break, should you want to change jobs and you need to take 3 months off to find a new job. That's what gives you that freedom to pursue what you want to do and give you that financial well-being that most people are looking for. And after that, once you're done with the emergency fund, then invest more, invest more, invest more, live, and then give, give a little bit back to the community as well. And that's so those that's my that's my formula. And please, Tyler, please give us your input.
I like it. You make a lot of good points, especially with the retirement accounts. Once you get the debt under control, do not wait to start saving in your retirement accounts. Oftentimes you might be automatically enrolled in some accounts, and they'll set a default percentage as to how much you're saving. Sometimes it's a very small amount, and you don't actually look at it or realize it. And a year goes by, 2 years go by, and you're wondering why you're saving so little. You need to pay attention to those accounts. You might need to up the percentage that is actually being withheld from your paycheck and going into your retirement account. So it's something that, unfortunately, I know you guys have a lot on your plate, but you need to actively focus on it and pay attention to it, even if it's just for a weekend. You got to pay attention to it. A lot of times, a lot of residency programs, you will be automatically participating in a retirement plan. It's you're not going to be a lot in there. You're on a resident salary. We know that. But don't forget it when you leave, you go out into practice. Don't forget that if you had a retirement plan, that's your money to take with you. What you do with that is kind of going to depend on your situation. You can roll it over into your new employer's plan. You can roll it over into an IRA. You can roll it over into a traditional IRA, or Roth IRA. Dr. Spath mentioned you have that backdoor Roth IRA available to you. So you need to be careful with what you do with those rollovers. If you roll it over into a traditional IRA, it plays kind of funny games with those backdoor Roth IRAs, in terms of how you're going to be taxed on the conversions. So you need to be careful with all of that. You might want to move it to your employer-sponsored plan. That way you don't have that money in IRAs, and that backdoor Roth IRA is, wide available to you. So there's a lot of things that you can do, but it's one of those things you need to pay attention to. You need to make sure you're saving enough. And you need to pay attention to the investment choices as well. So if you just set it, however you leave it, however your employer set it up for you automatically, you might be saving very little and have be paying a lot in expenses for the investment choices that you were automatically put in. So you need to pay attention to it. Make sure you're investing how you want, keep the expenses low, make sure you're saving enough.
Absolutely.
I would make a couple comments too. Going back to what our first conversation was about housing and debt, there's good debt and there's bad debt. Good debt is fixed to assets that are sellable. There's bad debt like student loan debt, which y'all have, that can't ever go away, can't bankrupt it. So I would say that if you're coming out with debt, whether it's consumer debt, car loans, credit cards, student loans, you need to have a plan for that. Definitely need to have a plan for student loans. You got to decide, am I going to struggle through this forgiveness route, or am I going to just knock this stuff out? And you're going to have an income where you can do that, because I think what everybody wants at the end of the day is flexibility, right? You want 3 to 6 months living expenses because you want flexibility, right? You've worked too hard. You're way too smart. Trust me, finances is not complicated. What you do every day, is much more complicated than finances, but it's going to take time. And it's going to take some effort to learn. Just like if you're studying for your TESOL right now, you're spending how many hours studying for that stuff, and it's a sample board exam. How much time do you really spend looking at finances, right? There's a lot of good resources out there that really break this down to you. And so I'd say, one, understand what good debt, bad debt is, and knock out those student loans because you want flexibility. You do not want a ball and chain to follow you around. Number two is, again, I'm going to talk about risk a lot because risk is a real thing. Tyler didn't comment on it, but disability insurance, you need to realize that you need to insure yourself. Unless you have enough money set aside, which some people do, especially later in your career, you may not need disability insurance because you've got enough of a nest egg set up that if you could not work at your day job, right? You could survive without it, right? You can make enough off your investments. And coming out of training, I think there's very few of us that are in that realm. And so I would say you need to get that locked down because right now you've got a lot more debt then you have assets most likely. And so if you look at the personal balance sheet that you have, you're in the negative hole. And I would encourage everybody to put a balance sheet together. Google balance sheet. How do I do it? Very simple. Most businesses have it. You need to have that breaking down so you understand what your actual net worth is and what you actually owe, right? And what you actually own. It's pretty eye-opening when you see it. And then you realize, well, I need to insure myself and my family against that, right? So you're going to look at disability insurance, right? If I can't work, am I going to get paid? And then you're going to look at life insurance, right? Like you're going to need to get good term life insurance. And that's really just going to protect you up until the point you think you're going to have an asset value on your balance sheet that's much higher than your liabilities. It's going to take care of all the people in your life. And so, again, a lot of this comes down to risk mitigation, which is why I say getting the student loan debt off your balance sheet is very important because it's not fixed to an asset. Tyler, any comments on that? I mean, you set me up with my first disability policy in residency.
Yeah, no, you got it. A lot of residents, it's one of those things where, they never imagine it happening to them. You're at the hospital every single day, you see sick people, but the residents are, you're young, you're healthy, nothing's ever going to happen to you. We've seen residents become disabled during residency, and they don't have disability insurance other than what the hospital provides to them. And most of the time, it's very little, very minimal. It's very hard to, especially when you're in California, pay your rent, put food on the table, continue making your car payments if all you have is $3,500 a month coming in from whatever plan your employer provided, and that's fully taxable to you as well. So you need to get your own disability insurance to protect yourself. That's all it is. As Dan mentioned, you just need to protect yourself. You could very easily, just as easily as me, anybody else, wind up as a patient, the same as the people that you are treating. Nobody wants to think about it, but you need to, at the end of the day, protect yourself. You go to work every day to make a living, to earn your paycheck. If that suddenly stops, what do you do? And until you have enough money saved up, as Dan mentioned, where you can essentially take a forced early retirement, then you don't need disability insurance at that point. That might come when you're 50 years old, when you're 45, if you're lucky. You just need to be able to protect yourself until you don't need the insurance anymore.
Yeah, and
And
the key. Oh, sorry, Dr. Edwards, you first.
I would say that, even if nothing happens to you while you're young, when you are young is the time to get a policy because it'll be cheaper, and you will be less likely to fail for medical exemptions. And then what you want to do is you make sure you get the appropriate riders. And so you want someone like Tyler, who's an independent agent who can shop around for multiple through multiple companies. You don't want to go to company X and get their insurance through their agent because then you'll be quite limited there. And then make sure you get the appropriate riders to cover you for your future increases without you having to do additional underwriting or redo that medical exam. So this is one thing that coming out of residency, everybody should do if you do nothing else.
Absolutely. And the key words that you're looking for is own occupation. A lot of the employer-sponsored policies don't have true own occupation definitions of disability, but you guys, as surgeons specifically, there are things that you have to be able to do that a lot of, yeah, if you can't do surgery, you could still probably teach, but you wouldn't make as much, right? But if you develop a tremor or something, God forbid, disabling happens, it's not fully disabling. You can still be covered for your lifestyle, to protect the lifestyle you're currently at. But if you have an own occupation policy, which means basically the policy will pay out if you can't do the actual job that you're j doing right now, even if you can do something else. A lot of these employer policies are, their definition of a disability is basically total disability. So if you're completely bedbound or you can't work any job, then that they will pay you a little bit of money. Like Tyler mentioned, it would be taxable. But since if you buy your own occupation disability insurance, number one, it's not taxable because you're paying the premiums, not the employer, but also it's transferable with you. It goes with you. And like Dr. Edwards mentioned, if you get it early, or if you're somehow able to extend the resident policy that you have, or get it in residency at the resident as at the resident rate, and then have the right riders to just increase the amount of coverage as you become an attending, that's the way to win that game, because this own occupation disability policies can be quite expensive if they're good. So if you're a woman, you're looking at paying 2 to 6% of your annual salary. And unfortunately, it's higher for women than it is for men, or for men, it's 1 to 3% of their annual salary, because we tend to have more risk, I guess, statistically speaking. It is a good bit of investment, but you are protecting your future income, and you have invested so much time in your brain and your skills that if you were to lose that, you don't also want to lose your livelihood and have to downgrade your family's lifestyle. This is a way to protect your family's lifestyle going forward until you can do it on your own.
Right. There are some problems with relying solely on an employer-provided disability coverage. As Dr. Spath mentioned, the definition of disability is just not the same as what you would want. If you change your job, you typically cannot take coverage with you, then you're left with nothing. Then you got to go out, get your own coverage. Maybe at that point you develop some sort of pre-existing condition, you can't get your own coverage. It's fully taxable if your employer is providing it to you and they're paying for it. And typically, the benefit is going to be limited. So it might be 60% of your income up to a set maximum. Depending on your income, you might right away be hitting that maximum benefit of, say, $15,000 a month. And that's fully taxable. It's only really going to be replacing a small percentage of your income. So even if you have something through work, there are a lot of limitations to employer-provided disability plans. And that's why it's always important to carry your own coverage, which is going to provide you with a lot more protection.
Just in the interest of time, I want to ask one more question, and then we'll kind of wrap things up. But in terms of financial advisors and investment managers, what do you recommend for, early career attendings who are now they have money and they're maybe not super aware of what to do with it? What do you recommend in terms of where to find a financial advisor? Do you need one, or should you just be doing it on your own?
Well, I don't know. I have thoughts. I had one, and I was paying a. I hate to say the words because it hurts my heart to say the words. I was paying a 2% AUM fee, not for long, not for long, not for long, but for long enough that I was that was the end of that, and I manage everything myself. It takes time, though. It does take time, and it's not for everyone. You don't have to do it. But whatever you do, you need to be educated and you need to know if you're getting good advice or not getting good advice. So I think most people who don't have a strong interest will probably find an advisor. You want somebody who's independent, who you pay by the hour, and you will probably need a different advisor for different things. You may need somebody for disability insurance. You may need an estate planner. You may need an investment advisor. So, or somebody for, your taxes. So you, one person will probably not be able to do everything for you, but you need to be the captain of your own financial ship. And I would not outsource that responsibility to somebody else because nobody's going to care about your money more than you do.
Right. When it comes, especially to financial advisors, you need to be aware of fees. Being in this business, I will tell you there are a lot of fees that you may not even be aware of. You need to make sure you know whoever you're working with, you need to know how they are registered. Whether they are an independent investment advisor, whether they are doing business through a broker dealer. If they're doing business through a broker dealer, chances are they might be selling you a mutual fund and earning a commission. I mean, I hate to put a bad rap on my own business here, but I've seen people tell residents, "Oh, buy your disability insurance from me and I'll do your investments for free." It's not for free. They're selling you loaded mutual funds that are earning a commission. There are a lot of tricky things that go on, and you need to be fully aware of who is getting paid and how they are getting paid, how much they're getting paid. So you need to ask about fees. You need to ask about whether they are selling you investments versus, managing your investments for a set annual fee. It should not be anywhere near 2%. It should be, half a percent, if that. Expenses are probably going to be one of the most important things for you to keep your eye on.
Absolutely. You know, there are a lot of ways that doctors get ripped off by the financial industry, and that's why there are so many doctors out here that are like me, working full time but also taking their time to teach other doctors how not to get ripped off. So there's a lot of free information out there, a lot of blogs, a lot of podcasts that you can listen to educate yourself. Even if you do end up hiring a financial advisor, make sure you know the right questions to ask. Make sure you know how to evaluate if you're getting a good return or not, what the fees are. And you can do that by listening to many of my colleagues' podcasts, and they're also mine, as mentioned earlier. But just look at physician finance bloggers. We're all out there just trying to teach other physicians the things to watch out for so we don't get ripped off.
Yeah, I
Thank
would
you.
say again, oh, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, please. Go ahead.
I think my last statement there would be, you're smart, right? Educate yourself on this. Trust me, you've learned way more than most people have ever learned in their life about a lot of things. You have a very high capacity to learn. The finances is not complicated. No, it may not seem that interesting at first, but there are some really good books out there that are very basic, that are a lot of times are just thought process, mind, kind of changing your mind, the way you think about money and how you earn money. I think getting into that, I did that my intern year, really. I just kind of stumbled upon it, and it really just transformed the way I've been able to set up my career. And so I think, take the time to go out there and learn, before you go out and seek advice. I think it's always good to know, like, if somebody's going to come to you for surgery, most of the time they've already researched you. They're like, yeah, I read your LinkedIn profile, I've looked at this, I've saw videos of you talking. They don't just come in and say, hey, stop my heart, good luck, it looks like you're good. No, I mean, they're doing their research on what they're doing. So spend the time to do it. And the other thing I would say is that, like, the only thing you cannot buy, right? Money's, we're talking about it today, we're talking about money, but I would tell you, the more you try to hold on to it, the more you're going to lose it. The more you are abundant mindset is going to make a difference. And I would tell you, the one thing that none of us will ever be able to buy back is another day. You can't buy any more time. So, go into your negotiations, go into your career, just realizing, like, you can work all you want, but I can tell you on your deathbed, you're not going to be like, hey, I wish I did another cabbage on a Saturday or a Friday night, instead of spending time with my family. You will never say that. So just remember that, that you can't buy back your time. Money does have value, and look at how much money you make per hour that you work, right? Look at those metrics. Just see what the key performance indicators are, right? Because you may say, man, I'm only making like $200 an hour. It's not worth giving up my kid's soccer game for $200. I'm dipping. I'm going to go to my kid's soccer game. You know what I mean? Like, you need to think about that. So that's my final statement.
Thank you. And that wraps into our overall concept of well-being, that today we're talking about financial well-being. We talked about contracts and components of net contracts that will help us in the future. We talked a little bit about estate planning when you do have the money. We talked about home and how to invest and use that debt to work for you, and overall debt planning. We talked about disability, which is an important issue. It came up in both financial webinars, and also how to get a financial advisor. And just to bring you to the discussion of our last webinar, we talked about how to build a budget, how to build a team for your finances, side hustles, and additional income and investment management. So, if you're interested in any of these topics, it's mostly just a way for you to start out with your own self-education, and hopefully, you can at least get the topics under control. So, thank you so much to all of our speakers and participants for contributing to this. This is absolutely information that I never received. I wish that I had, and I've learned so much today. Thank you. And Dr. Olds.
Thank you so much to everybody who attended, and thank you to all of our panelists. That was a great discussion. I learned a lot. I'm sure that everyone who has attended and everyone who watches this will learn a lot. For those of you who are attending, these are the email addresses for all of us in case anyone has further questions that you want to reach out to anyone specifically about. The recording will be available on the TSRA YouTube as well as our website. And the audio will be available as a podcast on the Spotify and on the SoundCloud for TSRA if you want to listen to it again. We are looking forward to our next set of webinars. So keep a lookout for those. Those will be announced through the TSRA newsletter and also on the TSRA Twitter or X, as we call it now. I hope everyone has a good night, and thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.